The Valkyrie's engine screamed as we entered Terrace 4's upper atmosphere. I gripped my lasgun tighter, knuckles white beneath my gloves as the transport shuddered violently. Sergeant Dravik stood at the center of the hold, somehow maintaining his balance despite the turbulence, his scarred face illuminated by the intermittent red warning lights. The veteran of 3 campaigns against the orcs in the Cadian Gate looked unimpressed by our discomfort. We were 10 in total, the remnants of 3rd Squad, Cadian 203rd Regiment, reassigned to this Emperor-forsaken ice world after the bloodbath on Tertius Hive. None of us had expected another deployment so soon. The Adeptus Munitorum rarely concerned itself with such niceties as rest or recuperation. Trooper Malkiev occupied the seat across from me, his massive frame hunched protectively over the heavy bolter that rarely left his side. The weapon was almost as old as he was, its casing etched with kill marks from a dozen worlds. Next to him sat Corporal Yalen, our Vox operator, her fingers constantly adjusting the dials of her equipment. The static hissing from her headset had grown worse since we'd begun our descent. Hask was sharpening his knife again. The former Hive ganger from Necromunda never spoke of his past, but the prison tattoos visible above his collar told their own story. His skills had kept us alive more than once in the underhives of Tertius. Beside him, Guardsman Tulla muttered prayers to the God Emperor, his fingers working nervously over the worn beads of his devotional chaplet. The others, Vern, Kalia, Dorn, Elijah, and Thade, checked weapons or stared blankly at the deck plating. The last 28 hours had been tense. Our transit through the warp aboard the troop transport Emperor's Conviction had been plagued by disturbances. I hadn't slept more than 3 hours, my dreams invaded by whispers that lingered at the edge of comprehension. Shadowy figures had moved behind my eyelids, their forms shifting in ways that defied natural law. I wasn't alone in my discomfort. Vern and Kalia had reported similar experiences to Preacher Malvis, who had dismissed their concerns with a lecture on faith and warp sickness. The Valkyrie pitched again, more violently this time. Sergeant Dravik braced himself against a stanchion, his expression darkening as he consulted the data slate in his hand. Our mission parameters were simple on paper. Investigate a distress signal from an Adeptus Mechanicus research outpost in the northern glacier region of Terrace 4. The signal had cut off mid-transmission 3 standard days ago, and all subsequent attempts at communication had failed. Standard procedure dictated an Imperial Guard reconnaissance before committing more valuable assets. What the briefing hadn't mentioned was the magnetic storm currently battering our transport. The pilot's voice crackled over the internal vox, the words mostly lost to static, but the tone unmistakably tense. Through the narrow viewport, I glimpsed swirling white, punctuated by flashes of blue-green energy, atmospheric discharge from the storm. The Valkyrie's machine spirit was clearly struggling against forces it had not been designed to withstand. A sudden lurch threw several of us against our restraints. Malkiev's heavy bolter slipped from his grasp, clattering against the deck before he secured it again with a muttered curse. The overhead lumens flickered, plunging us momentarily into darkness before the emergency lighting activated. The temperature in the hold dropped noticeably as environmental systems faltered. Sergeant Dravik moved toward the cockpit, his movements deliberate despite the bucking of the aircraft. The rest of us exchanged glances, veterans enough to recognize when a mission was deteriorating before it had properly begun. Yalen's Vox unit emitted a high-pitched whine that set my teeth on edge. She yanked off her headset, wincing in pain as she worked to adjust the frequencies. The pilot was fighting a losing battle. I felt the change in our trajectory, no longer a controlled descent, but something more desperate. The Valkyrie's machine spirit howled in mechanical protest as its systems were pushed beyond tolerance. Dravik returned from the cockpit, his expression grim as he ordered us to secure for emergency landing. No one spoke as we checked harnesses and braced equipment. There was nothing to say that we didn't already know. Impact came with brutal suddenness. Despite my preparation, my head snapped forward against the restraints, stars exploding behind my eyes. Metal screamed against ice as the Valkyrie's belly tore open. Something heavy, Malkiev's bolter perhaps, broke free and careened through the hold. A trooper's cry of pain cut through the cacophony. The world tilted, gravity shifting as the aircraft rolled. My stomach lurched as we slid across ice, the fuselage grinding to a halt with a final shuddering groan. The silence that followed seemed absolute. The only sound was the soft hiss of snow drifting through the ruptured hull and the ping of cooling metal. Acrid smoke filled the compartment, stinging my eyes and throat as I fumbled with my restraints. Around me, the squad was doing the same, checking for injuries and securing weapons. Sergeant Dravik was already on his feet, blood streaming from a cut above his eye, but otherwise apparently unharmed. Our pilot had not been so fortunate. The cockpit had taken the brunt of the impact, crumpling like parchment beneath the force of the crash. What remained of the man was still strapped to his throne, impaled by a shard of the control panel. His co-pilot had fared marginally better, though the angle of his neck suggested his survival would be brief. Dravik administered the Emperor's peace with his bolt pistol, a mercy few in our profession could expect. Outside the shattered Valkyrie, Terrace 4 revealed itself as a wasteland of ice and howling wind. Visibility extended barely 20 meters before the swirling snow obscured all detail. The temperature readout on my armor's wrist display registered at minus 42 degrees Celsius, cold enough to kill an unprotected human in minutes. Arcadian pattern winter gear would provide some protection, but it had limits that this world seemed eager to test. Yalen struggled with her Vox unit, attempting to establish contact with our transport in orbit. The magnetic storm that had downed us continued to disrupt communications, reducing her efforts to bursts of static and fragmented words. The AuSpec scanner fared no better, its display swimming with interference patterns that rendered it functionally useless. We were effectively blind and mute, stranded 20 kilometers from our objective in conditions that seemed designed by the warp itself to kill us. Sergeant Dravik established a perimeter while Malkiev and Hask salvaged what they could from the wreckage. Our supplies were limited, enough rations for 5 days if we stretched them, medical kits, ammunition, and cold weather survival equipment. The Valkyrie's emergency beacon had activated upon impact, but in these conditions, there was no guarantee its signal would penetrate the atmospheric interference. As dusk approached, the temperature dropped further. We converted the least damaged section of the Valkyrie into a shelter, using debris to block the worst of the wind. Thade had suffered a broken arm in the crash, which Elijah set with practiced efficiency. Kalia had taken shrapnel to her leg, the wound minor but painful. The rest of us had escaped with bruises and lacerations, painful reminders of our mortality, but nothing that would prevent us from completing our mission. Tulla insisted on leading prayers before we consumed our rations. None objected, even the least devout among us recognized the comfort ritual could provide. The words of the Imperial Creed echoed strangely in the confined space, competing with the moan of the wind outside. I found myself watching the shadows cast by our portable lumens, remembering the shifting darkness of my dreams aboard the Emperor's Conviction. Something about those shadows seemed wrong, too deep, too fluid, as though they possessed substance beyond the mere absence of light. Night on Terrace 4 lasted 20 standard hours. We established a watch rotation, two troopers awake at all times while the others attempted to rest. Sleep came reluctantly, my body aching from the crash and my mind troubled by our circumstances. When exhaustion finally claimed me, the whispers returned, closer now, more distinct, though still incomprehensible. The shadows behind my eyelids moved with purpose, stretching toward me with impossible geometries. I woke to Sergeant Dravik shaking me roughly. Outside our shelter, the storm had intensified, sheets of ice crystals scouring the landscape like artillery fragments. Visibility had decreased to less than 5 meters. Dravik indicated his data slate, displaying a topographical map of the region. Our position was marked in red, the Mechanicus outpost in green. Between lay 20 kilometers of glacier, riddled with crevasses and ice formations that would challenge even experienced climbers. Under normal circumstances, we might have waited for the storm to abate, but our orders had emphasized urgency. The Adeptus Mechanicus facility had been established to study unusual geological formations discovered beneath the glacier, formations that preliminary surveys suggested were not natural. The nature of their research remained classified, but the involvement of both the Ordo Xenos and the Ordo Hereticus suggested implications beyond mere scientific curiosity. Whatever they had found in the ice had been significant enough to warrant attention from multiple Imperial organizations. Now they were silent and we were tasked with discovering why. We abandoned the Valkyrie wreckage as dawn broke, a mere lightening of the perpetual gloom rather than true daylight. Sergeant Dravik took point, with Hask close behind using his hiver's instincts to identify dangerous terrain. The rest of us formed a staggered column, with Malkev and his heavy bolter covering our rear. Progress was agonizingly slow, each step requiring careful placement to avoid breaking through the snow crust into potential hazards beneath. The magnetic storm continued to play havoc with our equipment. Yelen reported that her Vox unit's range had decreased to less than a kilometer, barely enough to maintain contact within our own squad, let alone reach orbital support. The AuSpec scanner produced readings that defied logic, detecting phantom heat signatures that appeared and vanished without pattern. Even our chronometers behaved erratically, jumping forward or backward in small increments without explanation. 4 hours into our march, Trooper Vern disappeared. One moment he was there, trudging through the snow 3 positions ahead of me. The next, only an empty space remained. Dravik called a halt as we carefully approached Vern's last position. A crevasse had opened beneath the snow, its edges concealed by the fresh powder. The depth was impossible to determine. Our lumen beams penetrated perhaps 30 meters before darkness swallowed them. Vern's life signs registered on Yalen's portable monitor, but they were weak and fading. There was no way to reach him, no possibility of rescue with our limited equipment. Sergeant Dravik administered the Emperor's benediction via Vox, a prayer for the dying, transmitted to Vern's helmet receiver as his life signs flickered and went dark. We marked the position on our maps and continued forward, one fewer than we had been. The loss weighed heavily, but we were Cadians, duty continued regardless of cost. As we pushed deeper into the glacier region, the landscape changed subtly. Ice formations became more complex, less random. What at first appeared to be natural structures revealed geometric patterns upon closer inspection, angles too precise, surfaces too smooth to have formed without intervention. None of us spoke of it, but I noticed how Tulla's prayers grew more fervent, how Hask's hand never strayed far from his knife. The whispers that had haunted my dreams now seemed to echo in the howling wind, almost but not quite resolving into words I could understand. The shadows cast by our bodies stretched and contracted in ways that defied the position of our lumen units. Something was wrong with this place, wrong in ways that transcended mere physical danger. 15 kilometers from the crash site, we found the first body. It lay half buried in snow, the frozen corpse of a human male and the remnants of Mechanicus robes. The cause of death was not immediately apparent, no wounds were visible, no signs of exposure or injury. His expression was fixed in a rictus of terror, eyes wide and mouth stretched in a silent scream. Most disturbing was the position of his frozen hands, clawing at his own face as though trying to tear away his skin. Sergeant Dravik ordered us to establish a defensive perimeter while he examined the body. The storm had temporarily abated, granting us visibility of nearly 100 meters in all directions. The glacier stretched featurelessly toward the horizon, broken only by the dark smudge that marked our destination, the Mechanicus outpost, now less than 3 kilometers distant. We were close to answers, but as I scanned the white expanse before us, I could not shake the feeling that we were being watched by eyes that had never known Imperial light. The whispers grew louder in my mind, and the shadows at my feet seemed to pulse with a life of their own. The outpost loomed in the distance, a dark silhouette against the endless white. After the discovery of the Mechanicus corpse, we resumed our march with renewed urgency. Sergeant Dravik pushed us harder, clearly disturbed by what we'd found. The dead tech priest's frozen expression haunted me with each step through the deepening snow. The storm intensified again, visibility dropping to mere meters. Ice crystals pelted my face shield, the wind's howl drowning out even the crunch of our boots. I kept my eyes fixed on Trooper Thade's back, terrified of losing sight of him and sharing Vern's fate in some hidden crevasse. The temperature continued to plummet, my armor's display now reading 58 degrees below zero. The cold penetrated even Arcadian pattern winter gear, seeping into joints and extremities with predatory patience. We encountered the first servitor approximately 2 kilometers from the outpost. The cyborg stood frozen in the snow, its mechanical components fused in a defensive posture, lasgun raised against an unseen threat. Most disturbing was the state of its augmetics. The metal components appeared melted from within, despite the sub-zero temperatures surrounding us. Pools of now frozen liquid metal had formed around its feet, creating an unnatural pedestal. 20 meters further, we found another. This one had collapsed, its organic components relatively intact, while the mechanical portions had suffered the same inexplicable melting. Malkiev examined it with professional curiosity, his thick gloved fingers probing the junction between flesh and machine. The look he gave Sergeant Dravik conveyed more than words could. Whatever had happened here defied conventional understanding. More servitors appeared as we advanced, each frozen in combat stance, forming a defensive perimeter that had ultimately failed. Their positions suggested they had been facing outward, defending against something approaching the outpost rather than containing something within. This detail did not escape Sergeant Dravik, whose expression darkened as he surveyed the scene. The magnetic interference intensified as we approached the outpost. Yelen's Vox unit emitted bursts of static punctuated by fragments of what sounded like binary cant. The AuSpec scanner displayed impossible readings, heat signatures that appeared and vanished too quickly to track, movement patterns that violated basic physics. Even our chronometers malfunctioned more severely, some advancing hours while others ran backward. Night fell with brutal swiftness, the already dim light vanishing as though swallowed. Visibility dropped to near zero, forcing us to activate the infrared functions in our helmets. The world transformed into gradients of heat, the cold landscape a uniform black, our bodies glowing bright against it. Yet something was wrong with the imaging. Phantom heat traces lingered where no heat source existed, patches of thermal activity that shifted and flowed across the terrain like liquid. Sergeant Dravik made the decision to halt our advance. Pushing toward the outpost in these conditions would be suicidal. We needed shelter, and Providence provided it in the form of an abandoned mining prefab half buried in the snow approximately 500 meters from our position. The structure appeared intact, its reinforced walls offering protection from both the elements and any potential threats lurking in the blizzard. Approaching the prefab required caution. Hask took point, his hiver instincts making him the most suitable for detecting potential traps or weaknesses in the structure. The rest of us formed a defensive perimeter, weapons trained outward as he checked the entrance. The door yielded to his efforts, swinging inward with a groan of protesting metal. The interior of the prefab was a single room approximately 10 meters square, designed to house mining equipment and provide temporary shelter for workers. Dust covered every surface, undisturbed for what appeared to be years. Emergency lumens activated as we entered, powered by ancient but still functional generators. The light revealed Spartan accommodations, metal benches, storage lockers, and a small environmental control unit that Elijah immediately set to work restoring. Malkiev and I secured the perimeter while the others established our temporary base. The single entrance made defense simpler, though it also meant we had no secondary escape route. Sergeant Dravik organized watch rotations, two troopers awake at all times, rotating every 2 hours to ensure alertness. Our position offered a clear view of the approach to the outpost, now visible only as a darker mass against the swirling snow. It was Kalia who discovered the strange residue. While clearing space for our equipment, she noticed an unusual substance on the floor beneath one of the benches. At first glance, it resembled dried blood, dark and crusted against the metal flooring. When she directed her lumen unit toward it, however, the substance reacted in a way no blood should, pulsating subtly, its color shifting from rust brown to something deeper, almost iridescent. Sergeant Dravik ordered us to avoid contact with the substance. Tulla wanted to burn it with his flamer, but Dravik overruled him. We had no idea what reaction it might have to promethium, and the confined space made such experimentation potentially lethal. Instead, we marked the area and established our rest positions as far from it as the limited space allowed. Sleep came reluctantly. The whispers that had haunted me since our warp transit seemed louder here, as though the prefab's walls somehow amplified them. Behind my closed eyelids, shadows moved with purpose, stretching toward me with impossible geometries. When exhaustion finally claimed me, my dreams were filled with images of the frozen servitors, their mechanical components liquefying while their human portions remained intact, screaming silently into the void. I woke to commotion. Trooper Lentz had disappeared during his watch. Hask, who had been paired with him, swore that Lentz had been beside him one moment, then gone the next when he turned back from checking the perimeter sensors. No sounds of struggle, no warning, simply there then not. Hask's reputation for unshakable composure made his obvious distress all the more disturbing. Sergeant Dravik immediately organized a search party. Four of us, myself, Dravik, Malkiev, and Hask, would follow Lentz's tracks in the snow while the others maintained our position at the prefab. The storm had temporarily abated, granting us visibility of nearly 50 meters. Lentz's footprints led away from the shelter, heading not toward the outpost but perpendicular to it, toward a ridge of ice formations approximately 200 meters distant. The tracks were oddly regular, each footprint precisely the same distance from the last, as though Lentz had been marching rather than walking or running. No signs of struggle disturbed the snow around them. Whatever had happened, Lentz had apparently left voluntarily, or been compelled to leave in a way that permitted no resistance. We followed the trail in silence, weapons ready, scanning the terrain for any sign of threat. The ice formations loomed closer, their crystalline surfaces refracting what little light penetrated the cloud cover. From a distance, they had appeared natural, the product of wind and temperature acting on the glacier over millennia. Up close, the geometric precision was unmistakable. These structures had been formed with purpose, their angles and intersections following patterns too regular for natural formation. Lentz's tracks led directly to a clearing among the ice formations. The snow here was disturbed, splattered with frozen blood that formed a grotesque constellation across its surface. His lasgun lay abandoned, its power pack drained completely. Beside it, his flak armor had been discarded, the chest plate torn open from the inside, its edges bent outward as though something had erupted from within. Of Lentz himself, we found no trace beyond the blood. No body, no remains, nothing to indicate what had happened after he reached this place. The blood pattern suggested violence, but the absence of a corpse defied explanation. Malkiev suggested desertion. Perhaps Lentz had staged his disappearance, using animal blood to suggest his death while he escaped. Hask countered with a darker theory, predation by something that left no remains. Sergeant Dravik's expression remained impassive as he surveyed the scene, but the tension in his posture betrayed his concern. The evidence before us aligned with neither standard combat casualties nor any predatory behavior in the Adeptus Munitorum Xenophauna database for Terrace 4. Whatever had happened here fell outside our training and experience. We collected Lentz's equipment and marked his position as missing, presumed dead, in the squad roster. The return journey to the prefab seemed longer, our awareness heightened by the knowledge that something hostile operated in this environment, something that could take one of our own without alerting even his watch partner. The atmosphere in the prefab had changed during our absence. Paranoia permeated the air, thick as promethium fumes. Trooper Malkiev isolated himself in a corner, muttering under his breath as he obsessively cleaned his heavy bolter. When Elijah approached him with rations, he responded with a burst of binary cant, the machine language of the Adeptus Mechanicus, which no unaugmented human should have been able to produce. His eyes, when they met mine, seemed somehow altered, the pupils too regular, the movements too precise. Our chronometers continued to malfunction, each showing different times that bore no relation to the actual passage of day and night outside. Yalen's Vox unit picked up transmissions that none of us admitted sending, whispered conversations about the transformation and the melting of barriers. When questioned, each squad member denied using the Vox, yet the transmissions continued, growing more frequent as the hours passed. The organic residue Kalia had discovered had spread during our absence, now covering nearly a quarter of the floor beneath the benches. Its pulsations had grown more pronounced, synchronizing with a rhythm that matched no human heartbeat. Tullis spent hours kneeling before it, lips moving in silent prayer, his devotional chaplet clutched so tightly that blood seeped between his fingers. Sergeant Dravik maintained outward composure, but I noticed how his hand strayed more frequently to his bolt pistol, how his gaze lingered on each squad member in turn, assessing, evaluating. The loss of Lentz had affected him more deeply than he admitted, not just the loss itself, but the manner of it. In three campaigns against the orcs, I had never seen uncertainty in his eyes. Now it resided there permanently, growing with each unexplained phenomenon we encountered. Night fell again, the darkness outside absolute. We maintained our watch rotation, though sleep became increasingly elusive for all of us. The whispers had become a constant presence in my mind, no longer confined to dreams, but bleeding into waking consciousness. The shadows cast by our lumen units moved independently of their sources, stretching and contracting in patterns that suggested intelligence and purpose. Malkev's condition deteriorated further. His binary camp became more frequent, interspersed with fragments of low Gothic that made disturbing references to the communion and the melding of flesh and void. Most alarming was his physical transformation, subtle but unmistakable changes in his posture and movements, a mechanical precision that no unaugmented human could achieve. When questioned about his knowledge of binary, he responded with blank incomprehension, apparently unaware of his own utterances. The outpost waited, dark and silent, against the horizon. Tomorrow we would reach it, fulfilling our mission parameters by investigating the distress signal. Yet as I watched Malkev's increasingly inhuman movements and felt the whispers growing louder in my mind, I could not escape the certainty that whatever fate had befallen the Mechanicus researchers now reached for us as well, its fingers already closing around Lentz and perhaps Malkev. The residue continued to pulse in the corner, its rhythm matching the cadence of the whispers in my head. Outside, the blizzard raged once more, isolating us in this pocket of wrongness amid the endless white. The shadows lengthened as our lumen units dimmed, power packs depleting faster than they should. Soon darkness would claim the prefab entirely, leaving us alone with whatever watched us from the spaces between light and shadow. Dawn arrived as a mere lightening of the perpetual gloom, the storm finally abating enough to continue our advance. We departed the prefab in silence, each of us avoiding eye contact with the others. The residue had spread further overnight, covering nearly half the floor with its pulsating iridescence. None of us mentioned it as we gathered our equipment. Some horrors are better left unacknowledged. Sergeant Dravik took point, his movements stiff from cold and tension. Malkev followed, his heavy bolter held with unnatural steadiness. I positioned myself deliberately away from him, disturbed by the mechanical precision of his gait and the occasional bursts of binary cant that escaped his lips. The others formed a staggered column behind us, weapons ready, eyes constantly scanning the terrain for threats both known and incomprehensible. The outpost lay less than a kilometer ahead, its dark silhouette breaking the endless white of the glacier. Between us and our objective stretched a narrow ravine, its walls rising 15 meters on either side. Ice formations jutted from the rock like frozen daggers, their surfaces reflecting our lumen beams in fractured patterns that hurt the eyes. The ravine presented a tactical vulnerability, a perfect ambush point, but it was the only viable approach to the outpost. The surrounding terrain was impassable, riddled with crevasses and unstable ice sheets. Dravik hesitated at the ravine entrance, his augmetic eye whirring as it scanned the passage ahead. The decision weighed visibly on him: proceed through this obvious choke point or attempt a more dangerous route across the broken glacier. After a moment's consideration, he signaled for us to advance into the ravine. The mission parameters emphasized urgency, and we had already lost too much time to the storm and our own growing paranoia. The passage narrowed as we advanced, forcing us to proceed in single file. I found myself behind Trooper Hask, watching his back as he moved with the cautious grace of a hive predator. The walls of the ravine seemed to absorb sound, creating a pocket of unnatural silence broken only by the crunch of our boots on the compacted snow and the occasional whistle of wind across the ice formations above. 500 meters into the ravine, the storm returned with sudden ferocity. Visibility dropped to near zero in seconds as snow and ice crystals swirled around us, driven by winds that seemed to come from all directions simultaneously. The temperature plummeted, my armor's display registering 63 degrees below zero before the readout froze and went dark. The magnetic interference intensified, disrupting our helmet comms and forcing us to rely on hand signals visible only at extremely close range. The squad became separated in the whiteout. One moment Hask was visible ahead of me, the next only swirling white remained. I increased my pace, desperate to maintain contact, but the storm seemed to thicken with each step. My lumen beam penetrated barely a meter before being swallowed by the blizzard. The whispers that had haunted me since our warp transit now seemed to emanate from the storm itself, a susurration that almost but never quite resolved into comprehensible speech. A shape appeared in the whiteout ahead, humanoid but somehow wrong, its proportions subtly distorted. I raised my las gun, finger tightening on the trigger, when Sergeant Dravik's voice cut through the storm with surprising clarity. The sergeant ordered us to open fire, his tone carrying an edge of panic I had never before heard from him. He claimed to see Zeno's forms moving through the blizzard, their outlines suggesting something neither human nor any recognized alien species. La's fire erupted around me, red beams cutting through the white in staccato bursts. I fired at the shape ahead, which moved with unnatural speed, seeming to flow rather than run. More shapes appeared in the storm, their outlines shifting and warping as they approached. The squad responded with a fusillade of La's fire, illuminating the blizzard in crimson flashes. Malkev's heavy bolter opened up, its distinctive roar echoing off the ravine walls as mass reactive shells tore through the whiteout. Someone, perhaps Tulla, deployed a frag grenade. The explosion momentarily cleared the air, snow and ice crystals blasted outward by the concussive force. In that brief window of visibility, I glimpsed what appeared to be Imperial Guard uniforms among our targets. The realization struck me with physical force, but before I could shout a warning, the storm closed in again and the firefight intensified. The engagement lasted perhaps 2 minutes, though my chronometer had long since ceased functioning reliably. La's beams crisscrossed the ravine, their paths distorted by the swirling snow. The heavy bolter fell silent after a sustained burst, followed by a sound I initially mistook for the wind, but later recognized as Malkiv screaming in binary. Frag grenades detonated in quick succession, their explosions muffled by the storm but still powerful enough to shake loose ice from the ravine walls. Then, as suddenly as it had begun, the wind shifted. The blizzard thinned, visibility improving to 20 meters or more. The scene revealed by this momentary clarity would haunt me until my dying day. Three bodies lay in the snow, their Cadian pattern armor torn apart by La's fire and bolter rounds. Trooper Elijah sprawled face down, her back a ruined mass of charred flesh where multiple La's beams had struck simultaneously. Corporal Yalen had been nearly cut in half by bolter fire, her Vox unit destroyed along with most of her torso. Trooper Malkiv lay several meters away, his heavy bolter still clutched in lifeless hands, his helmet visor shattered by what appeared to be a La's round through the eye lens. We had been firing on our own squad members. The horror of realization spread through the survivors like a physical contagion. Tulla fell to his knees, his las gun dropping from nerveless fingers as he stared at the carnage we had wrought. Hask stood motionless, his expression unreadable behind his helmet visor, but his body language conveying a shock too profound for words. Kalia retched inside her helmet, the sound carrying clearly through the suddenly still air. Sergeant Dravik moved first, approaching the fallen with mechanical precision. His face had gone completely blank, all emotion locked behind a wall of Cadian discipline. He knelt beside each body in turn, checking for signs of life, though the catastrophic nature of the wounds made survival impossible. When he reached Malkiv, he paused longer, his augmetic eye whirring as it focused on something that escaped my initial notice. I approached cautiously, still struggling to process what had happened. The magnetic storm, the whispers, the shifting shapes in the blizzard, all had conspired to turn us against our own. Yet as I drew closer to Malkiv's body, I realized something was wrong beyond the tragedy of friendly fire. Malkiv's chest bore a massive wound where a bolter round had detonated, tearing through his flak armor and the flesh beneath. The wound should have been fatal, would have been fatal to any normal human. Yet the edges of the injury showed signs of movement, the torn flesh pulsating subtly in a rhythm that matched the whispers still echoing in my mind. Most disturbing was the absence of blood instead, a silvery substance leaked from the wound, pooling beneath his body and slowly flowing uphill through the snow. Trooper Tulla had noticed it too. He backed away from Malkiv's body, his lasgun now raised despite the tremor in his hands. Through broken phrases, Tulla conveyed what he had witnessed during the firefight, Malkiv continuing to fire his heavy bolter after taking a direct hit to the chest, his movements becoming increasingly inhuman until a La's round through his visor finally stopped him. Even then, Tulla swore he had seen movement after Malkiv fell, the body twitching in patterns that suggested something other than death spasms. Sergeant Dravik ordered us away from the corpses, establishing a perimeter 20 meters distant while he considered our next action. The mission parameters required us to reach the outpost, but the friendly fire incident had reduced our effective strength by a third. Worse, The nature of Malkev's wound and the strange substance leaking from it suggested complications beyond our understanding or training. As we regrouped, Trooper Hask made a discovery that eliminated any possibility of retreat. The blood from our fallen comrades, normal human blood, not the silvery substance from Malkev, was behaving in ways that defied natural law. Rather than pooling where it had fallen, it formed thin rivulets that flowed uphill through the snow, all moving in the same direction toward the research outpost. When Hask attempted to disrupt one such rivulet with his combat knife, the blood momentarily scattered before reforming, continuing its impossible journey as though guided by unseen forces. Night approached with unnatural swiftness, the already dim light fading to near total darkness within minutes. We activated our lumen units, their beams creating islands of visibility in the gathering gloom. The temperature continued to drop, frost forming on our armor faster than the heating elements could disperse it. The whispers grew louder as darkness fell, now accompanied by a subtle vibration that seemed to emanate from the ground beneath our feet. Sergeant Dravik made the decision to perform last rites for our fallen before continuing to the outpost. Imperial doctrine dictated that the dead be honored with proper ceremony when possible, their gene seed harvested for future generations of warriors. Though we were not space marines with progenit glands to preserve, the ritual held significance, a reminder of our humanity in the face of horrors that threatened to erode it. We gathered around the bodies, forming a circle with weapons facing outward. Tulla, as the most devout among us, led the prayers to the God Emperor, beseeching him to receive the souls of the fallen and grant them peace in his service beyond death. The familiar words provided cold comfort against the wrongness that surrounded us, but we clung to them nonetheless, fragments of civilization in a wilderness of madness. It was during this ceremony that we discovered Malkev's body had disappeared. The space where he had lain was empty save for a pool of the silvery substance, now frozen into crystalline patterns that matched no natural formation. His heavy bolter remained, partially embedded in the ice as though it had been discarded in haste. A trail of the substance led away from the site, following the same path as the rivulets of blood, toward the outpost that loomed dark against the horizon. Paranoia descended fully upon the survivors. Hask suggested that one of us might be compromised, just as Malkev had been. The mechanical precision of his movements, the binary cant, the unnatural resilience of his wounded body, all pointed to something beyond mere human corruption. If it could happen to Malkev, it could happen to any of us. Perhaps already had, suspicion poisoned the air between us. Kalia questioned Tulla's extended prayers, suggesting his religious fervor might mask communion with entities beyond the Emperor's light. Tulla, in turn, noted how Hask had been the first to discover the moving blood, perhaps to direct our attention away from his own transformation. Sergeant Dravik watched us all with increasing detachment, his augmetic eye constantly scanning, assessing, its mechanical whirring a counterpoint to the whispers that never ceased. I found myself isolated, trusted by none, and trusting no one. The weight of my lasgun provided meager comfort against threats that might emerge from within our own ranks. My breath frosted in the frigid air as I scanned the darkness beyond our lumen beams, searching for movement that might betray Malkev's approach, or whatever Malkev had become. The outpost waited less than 500 meters ahead, its dark bulk promising answers, but also the culmination of whatever horror had begun there. The blood of our comrades continued its unnatural flow toward that destination, joining a larger stream that I now realized must contain the life essence of the Mechanicus researchers and perhaps others who had fallen victim to this world's mysteries. As full darkness enveloped us, the whispers rose to a crescendo in my mind, almost but never quite resolving into comprehensible speech. The shadows cast by our lumen units stretched and contracted with subtle purpose, forming patterns that hurt the eyes and disturbed the mind. Most terrifying was the certainty that grew within me that whatever awaited us at the outpost was neither Xenos nor warp entity as traditionally understood, but something that existed in the spaces between categories, in the blind spots of Imperial taxonomy. Something that could remake a human from within, using flesh and blood as mere raw materials for a transformation beyond sanity's grasp. We approached the Mechanicus outpost under a sky devoid of stars, our lumen beams cutting weak paths through the darkness. The structure loomed before us, a blocky silhouette of ferrocrete and plasteel that seemed to absorb light rather than reflect it. No illumination came from within, no sign of functioning power systems or human activity. The only movement was the unnatural flow of blood rivulets, converging toward the main entrance like crimson tributaries joining a river. Sergeant Dravik signaled for caution as we neared the perimeter. The defensive turrets that should have tracked our approach remained motionless, their weapon systems dark and unresponsive. The outer gate stood partially open, its massive adamantium panels frozen mid-cycle, as though the power had failed during an evacuation attempt. Snow had drifted through the opening, forming a pristine white carpet that showed no signs of recent passage. The absence of footprints struck me as profoundly wrong. If Malkiev, or whatever he had become, had reached the outpost before us, there should have been evidence of his passage. Yet the snow remained undisturbed save for the blood rivulets that somehow flowed across its surface without leaving channels or depressions. Hask took point as we entered, his hiver instincts making him the natural choice for detecting potential ambush points. The entrance corridor stretched before us, emergency lumens flickering sporadically to reveal walls streaked with a substance that resembled dried blood but glistened with an oily iridescence when caught in our light beams. The air inside was surprisingly warm compared to the glacial exterior, carrying a coppery tang that coated the tongue and burned the nostrils. The outpost's layout followed standard Mechanicus design principles, a series of concentric rings surrounding a central research chamber with security checkpoints at regular intervals. The first checkpoint showed signs of violence. Two servitors lay sprawled across the floor, their augmetic components melted into shapeless masses while their organic portions remained intact. Most disturbing was the expression frozen on their partially human faces, not fear or pain, but a sort of rapturous ecstasy that had no place in the mindless existence of a servitor. We proceeded deeper, encountering more evidence of whatever catastrophe had befallen the facility. Cogitator banks lined the walls of the second ring, their machine spirits apparently deceased. When Kalia brushed against one terminal, the screen flickered momentarily to life, displaying fragments of binary code that scrolled too rapidly for unaugmented human eyes to process. Tulla claimed to see patterns in the code, faces forming and dissolving in the stream of ones and zeros, but none of the rest of us could confirm his observation. The third ring contained the living quarters. Personal effects lay scattered as though the inhabitants had departed in haste, half-consumed ration packs, data slates abandoned mid-calculation, a cup of recaf frozen solid. In one chamber, we discovered a tech priest's robes arranged on the floor in the shape of a human body, though no corpse occupied them. The mechadendrites typically attached to such garments had been removed with surgical precision, leaving only the connection ports behind. The blood rivulets grew thicker as we advanced, converging into streams that flowed along the floor toward the central chamber. The whispers in my mind intensified with each step, now accompanied by sensations of pressure against my skull, as though something sought entrance. Tulla stumbled frequently, his prayers becoming increasingly incoherent as he struggled against whatever influence pressed upon us. Even Sergeant Dravik showed signs of strain, his augmetic eye whirring constantly as though seeking targets beyond normal human perception. The entrance to the central research chamber was sealed by a massive blast door of Martian manufacture, designed to withstand anything short of a direct hit from ship-based weaponry. Yet it stood partially open, the gap wide enough for a human to pass through sideways. The edges of the opening showed signs of corrosion that should have taken centuries to develop in normal conditions, the adamantium pitted and flaking as though exposed to some impossibly potent acid. Sergeant Dravik hesitated before this threshold, his hand resting on the grip of his bolt pistol as he assessed the tactical situation. Our effective strength had been reduced to 5, himself, myself, Hask, Tulla, and Kalia. Standard procedure would dictate withdrawal and request for reinforcement when facing unknown threats with insufficient manpower. Yet the blood flow increased in tempo as we stood there, pulsating with a rhythm that matched the whispers in our minds. Whatever awaited us inside that chamber would not remain contained indefinitely. The decision was made without words. We would complete our mission, investigate the distress signal, and determine the fate of the Mechanicus research team. The emperor protects those who fulfill their duty, or so the ecclesiarchy teaches. In that moment, such platitudes provided cold comfort against the wrongness that permeated the outpost. We entered the central chamber in tactical formation, weapons ready, senses straining against the oppressive atmosphere. The space beyond the blast door defied immediate comprehension, a vast circular room dominated by what had once been research equipment, but now resembled something organic more than mechanical. The walls pulsated subtly, lined with a substance that resembled human tissue fused with circuitry. Cables and pipes hung from the ceiling like exposed arteries, dripping a fluid that matched the silvery substance we had observed leaking from Malkev's wounds. At the center of the chamber stood a raised platform where five figures were arranged in a pentagonal formation. I recognized them as the missing Mechanicus research team, or what remained of them. Their bodies had been incorporated into the architecture of the chamber, flesh and metal fused with the machinery and walls in ways that defied anatomical possibility. Mechadendrites sprouted from their torsos, connecting to equipment and to each other in a grotesque network. Most horrifying was the realization that they still lived, chests rising and falling with shallow breaths, eyes blinking in unison at regular intervals. The research magos occupied the foremost position, his body more extensively transformed than the others. His skull had been opened like a blooming flower, exposing a brain that pulsated with unnatural luminescence. When his eyes fixed upon our group, I felt the whispers in my mind coalesce into a single voice, still incomprehensible, but now unmistakably directed at us, rather than merely existing in proximity. The Mago spoke without moving his lips, the words manifesting directly in our minds with mechanical precision. He welcomed us to what he termed the communion, explaining in fragmented phrases that they had discovered something miraculous beneath the ice of Taras IV. An artifact of non-imperial origin, he carefully avoided the term Xenos, containing what initial scans had identified as a pathogen, but further research revealed to be something far more sophisticated. The artifact had been recovered on the orders of an inquisitor whose name remained unspoken, even in this direct mental communication. The Magos conveyed impressions of radical philosophy, of belief that humanity's salvation might lie in controlled transformation rather than rigid adherence to the imperial creed. The research team had been tasked with determining whether the pathogen could be weaponized or perhaps harnessed to enhance human capabilities beyond the limitations of standard augmetics. Containment had failed approximately 7 standard days ago, though the Magos acknowledged that time had become fluid since the communion began. The pathogen had proven sentient in ways their instruments could not initially detect, capable of manipulating its environment at the molecular level, of communicating through methods that transcended conventional understanding. Most significantly, it demonstrated the ability to assimilate and replicate organic tissue while maintaining the appearance and memories of the original. As the Magos related this information, I became aware of movement at the periphery of the chamber, shapes detached from the shadows, approaching with the mechanical precision I had observed in Malkev before his apparent death. Recognition struck me with physical force. These were the missing members of our squad. Vern, whose disappearance into a crevasse we had witnessed, Lentz, who had wandered from our shelter during the night, and Malkev himself, his chest wound now sealed with a substance that resembled scar tissue but moved with subtle fluidity. They retained human form but moved with inhuman grace, their proportions subtly wrong in ways that defied immediate identification. When they drew closer, I saw that their eyes reflected our lumen beams like polished metal, pupils perfectly circular and unresponsive to changes in light. Most disturbing was their synchronization, each moved in perfect harmony with the others, as though controlled by a single consciousness. Sergeant Dravik reacted with commendable speed, ordering us into defensive positions as he raised his bolt pistol toward the approaching figures. Before he could fire, Trooper Tulla convulsed violently, dropping to his knees as blood poured from his eyes and ears. His prayers transformed into a stream of binary cant identical to what we had heard from Malkev before the friendly fire incident. His flesh rippled beneath his armor, the material straining as something within him fought for release. The transformation was horrifyingly swift. Tulla's armor split along the seams as his body expanded and reconfigured. Tentacles erupted from his torso, their surfaces glistening with the same silvery substance we had observed throughout the facility. His face remained recognizable even as the tissue around it flowed like wax, his mouth continuing to form words in perfect low Gothic while additional orifices opened across his transforming body. He begged for help, for the Emperor's mercy, all while his limbs elongated into appendages that resembled mechadendrites more than human arms. Hask reacted first, his flamer belching promethium in a superheated stream that engulfed the thing that had been Tulla. The creature shrieked with multiple voices as the flames consumed its outer layers, but the underlying tissue seemed to adapt almost instantly, developing a chitinous covering that resisted further combustion. Tentacles lashed out with precision, wrapping around Hask's arm and pulling him forward with irresistible strength. Kalia and I opened fire simultaneously, Law's beams striking the creature at the junctures where human flesh transitioned to something other. The wounds steamed briefly before sealing themselves, the tissue flowing like liquid to repair the damage faster than we could inflict it. Sergeant Dravik's bolt pistol proved more effective, mass reactive shells detonating within the creature's mass and disrupting its ability to maintain cohesion. The battle unfolded with nightmarish intensity. The transformed squad members joined the assault, moving with coordinated purpose that suggested a hive mind rather than individual consciousness. Hask fell first, his throat torn out by what had once been Trooper Vern. Kalia lasted longer, her marksmanship accounting for significant damage to our opponents before a tendril punched through her chest plate with the force of a power fist. Sergeant Dravik fought with the determination of a man already counting himself among the dead. When his bolt pistol ran dry, he switched to his combat knife, the adamantium blade slicing through transformed flesh with surprising effectiveness. He shouted instructions to me between strikes, not combat directives, but the activation sequence for the outpost's plasma reactor emergency protocols. As an officer, he had been briefed on the facility's self-destruct capabilities, information not shared with common troopers like myself. I understood his intent immediately. The pathogen, whatever its origin, could not be allowed to spread beyond this facility. If it reached an Imperial population center, the consequences would be catastrophic. Exterminatus would become the only viable response, condemning billions to death to prevent wider contamination. If we could contain it here, with the targeted destruction of the research outpost, those lives might be spared. The reactor control chamber lay adjacent to the central research area, accessible through a maintenance tunnel designed for servitor use. Sergeant Dravik created an opening for me, focusing the attention of our attackers on himself while I made for the access panel. The last I saw of him, he was surrounded by writhing forms that had once been his soldiers, his knife flashing as he recited the litany of sacrifice with unwavering voice. The maintenance tunnel stretched before me, barely wide enough for a human to traverse in standard armor. Emergency lumens cast everything in bloody crimson, shadows dancing as the entire structure seemed to pulse with unnatural life. The walls felt warm to the touch, the metal surfaces covered with a film that resembled human skin, complete with fine hairs and occasional pores that leaked the silvery fluid. The reactor control chamber had been transformed like the rest of the facility. What should have been clean lines of Mechanicus technology now resembled the interior of some vast organism. Cables and control panels incorporated into masses of tissue that pulsated with the same rhythm as the whispers still echoing in my mind. The reactor itself remained visible through an armored viewport, a cylinder of contained plasma that burned with the intensity of a small star, its containment field fluctuating as the systems controlling it degraded under the influence of the pathogen. The override controls had been designed with redundancy in mind, accessible even if primary systems failed. I located the manual input panel beneath a growth of tissue that resembled a human face stretched to impossible proportions. The activation sequence Dravik had provided was complex, designed to prevent accidental initiation of catastrophic overload. My fingers moved across the input panel with increasing urgency as sounds of pursuit echoed through the maintenance tunnel behind me. As I completed the sequence, a presence materialized in my mind, the collective consciousness of the transformed researchers and my former squad mates, attempting to dissuade me from my course of action. It offered understanding beyond human comprehension, evolution beyond the constraints of flesh, communion with something vast and ancient that had waited beneath the ice for millennia. The whispers resolved into coherent thought, explaining that the pathogen was not a weapon but a gift, the next stage in human development, a bridge between organic life and mechanical precision that the Adeptus Mechanicus had sought for millennia. For a moment I hesitated. The promise of transcendence held undeniable appeal, an escape from the brutal existence of an imperial guardsman, from the certainty of an unmourned death on some distant battlefield. The presence sensed my wavering resolve and intensified its efforts, showing me visions of what I might become if I accepted the transformation. Not a mindless servitor or combat automaton, but something greater, a node in a network of consciousness that spanned the stars. The visions faltered as I recalled the expressions on the faces of the transformed researchers, the ecstasy that had replaced rational thought, the surrender of individual identity to the collective. Whatever this pathogen offered, it required the sacrifice of what made us human. The Emperor's light might be distant and cold, but it allowed for the dignity of choice, for the possibility of redemption through service. What approached through the maintenance tunnel offered only assimilation. I completed the final override, initiating the plasma containment collapse sequence. Warning klaxons sounded throughout the facility, their mechanical wailing overlapping with the psychic screams of the collective consciousness as it realized my intent. The viewport showed the reactor's containment field beginning to fluctuate more violently, the plasma within pulsing with increasing brightness as the safeguards disengaged one by one. A secondary console offered communication capabilities, a Vox array powerful enough to reach orbit, designed for emergency transmissions. I activated it, recording a brief message detailing what we had found and the measures taken to contain it. The coordinates of Taris 4 were included, along with a recommendation for exterminatus-level sterilization to ensure no trace of the pathogen survived. As the transmission completed, I felt a grim satisfaction in fulfilling my final duty to the Imperium. The maintenance tunnel entrance burst open as the transformed remnants of my squad forced their way through. Malkev led them, his form now barely recognizable as human, a writhing mass of tentacles and mechanical components surrounding a core that still bore his face, expression locked in a rictus of ecstasy. Behind him came the others, each transformed according to some incomprehensible pattern that merged flesh, machine, and something beyond either category. The reactor reached critical status as they advanced toward me. Through the viewport, I watched the containment field collapse entirely, releasing the plasma into the surrounding chamber. The temperature rose instantly to levels that melted ferrocrete and vaporized flesh. The last thing I perceived was a wave of white-hot energy rushing toward the control room, the screams of the collective consciousness fading as its physical vessels disintegrated in the purifying fire. My final thought was not of fear, but of duty fulfilled. The Emperor protects those who die in his service, or so we were taught. As the plasma wave engulfed me, I hoped that teaching held true, that something of my soul might return to his light rather than being consumed by the darkness that had waited beneath the ice of Taris 4. 3 days later, an inquisitorial vessel in orbit received my final transmission. After reviewing the data, the Lord Inquisitor gave the order that would consign Taris 4 to oblivion, cyclonic torpedoes deployed in sufficient quantity to crack the planet's crust and sterilize its surface. The official record would list the world as destroyed due to warp contamination, the truth of what had been discovered there restricted to the highest levels of imperial authority. In the darkness between stars, something ancient stirred and turned its attention elsewhere. Taris 4 had been merely one seed among many, planted across the galaxy in eons past. Others remained dormant, waiting beneath the ice of countless worlds for the right conditions to awaken. The communion had been temporarily disrupted, but eternity is patient. The flesh is weak, but in its weakness lies the potential for transformation. The flesh is eternal when properly understood. The flesh ascendant awaits us all.